welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. And here is your host, Ryan Mack.
Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. Now, let's picture this. You're a merchant and you've been working all year on your marketing and you've been able to drive people to your store and your e-commerce site and they fill up their cart to go to make a purchase and then they're denied. And out of frustration, they either abandon their cart or leave the store upset. And not necessarily at the card in their wallet or the payment vehicle that they chose, but they're upset with your brand and your store experience. Well, as a merchant, you can argue that that's not really fair as you did everything right to get the customer into the store, but for some reason, the payment did not get authorized. And this is why authorization rates are vitally important for merchants. Not only can a denial of authorization mean a loss of sale, but it can hurt your brand as well. That's why on today's episode, I'm joined by Jim Maggots, who is the SVP of Omni Payments at PayPal, and Tim Sloan, who is the VP of Payments Innovation at Mercator Advisor Group, to talk about how merchants can take advantage of things like network tokenization, a two-sided network, and a stand-in decisioning that can make a huge impact on merchant authorization rates. So there's certainly a lot of great data and insights to take away from today's episode. So without any further delays, let's start the show.
So Jim and Tim, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode, where we're really going to be taking an in-depth look at authorization rates here. And before we kick things off, Tim, I understand that you helped author a co-sponsored report taking a look at authorization rates with PayPal. And I'm hoping maybe you can kind of give us a little bit of an insight to what's in that white paper, as I think it kind of helps to set the tone for this conversation that we're going to be having here today.
Yeah, sure, Ryan. And actually, it was a great experience from the perspective of taking a look at the overall process for authorization that PayPal uses, which utilizes a number of data points that are not readily available to others within the space based on PayPal's account structure, bank relationships and the rest. And in fact, it was so interesting that I then generated an additional report looking at the data, patching the patchwork of data that exists across merchants, acquirers, payment networks, issuers, issuing processors, data that can help us improve authorization rates and turn off fraud are scattered across that entire network. And so pulling it all together is one of the key attributes for being able to improve authorization rates and to be able to defend against fraud. And so it was a learning experience for me as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Tim. Certainly really appreciate the overview. Now, Jim, before we really kind of dive into the science, data science aspect of this and kind of the machine learning and the AI, I want to get a little bit of a definition of the term network tokenization. So perhaps maybe you could provide us with a brief high level of how really network tokenization works and how that really leads to higher authorization rates for merchants.
Thanks, Ryan. Think of a network token as a fake 16-digit number that's assigned to each of your card numbers that you have within your wallet. And so to the extent that PayPal or Uber or Google or anywhere that you've stored your 16-digit card or you have your 16-digit card available to be able to use, what network tokens do are basically provide a alternative number. And that alternative number is then assigned to the particular card that you have. And so when that number is utilized or your card is utilized, that number is utilized within the ecosystem that Tim just referenced. And then when issuers get that number, they recognize that that's Jim's Bank of America card or Tim's Citibank card. And what they do with that is they then utilize that just the same way they would use your 16-digit number. And why that's important is that there's a few things. Number one, is that that number is only known between the merchant, in this case PayPal, and the issuer and the network provider. It could be Visa, MasterCard, Amex, or Discover, and only the three of us have information to that number. So it's not like I could steal Tim's card number and have that available to me. Network tokens are a secure proprietary number that we have that's assigned to me and my specific card with that. The other thing that it does is it offers almost like a secret password, something called a cryptogram. And so that cryptogram is a piece of data that's, again, only known between us and the issuer and the network. And when we provide that token, not only is it a alternative number, it comes with a secret number, a secret cryptogram that the issuer knows that we've executed a safe, secure transaction of passive information between us. And so it's almost like double security in terms of what would be a normal card with that. What network tokens also enable is that it allows us that if you, as Ryan or Tim, have your card lost or stolen, and you get a different credential, a different card number, we can still use that token because it's not known outside of our ecosystem. So every time that you have a situation that I just went through where my card was lost and I had to go back to every one of those billing agreement merchants and re-enter my card, and I had a situation where a certain payment got declined for Comcast and they threatened to turn off my internet and phone and cable, automatically what tokens do is it enables us to generate your payment without having that new 16-digit number with you.
Yeah, tokens are a huge advance in that they're no longer tied to the plastic, right? They're now a digital enabled capability that, as Jim just mentioned, can be deployed on a one-to-one basis, on a one-to-many basis, or any other way necessary. And if it gets leaked, if it gets stolen, it doesn't go back to the account. It can be locked down to a particular merchant so that if that merchant loses it, it won't work. It's got a lot of benefits.
Yeah, I certainly love like the whole idea and just with everything to go on with network tokenization, because I mean, it really is that, in my view, just kind of that next level of security. You know, as Jim, as you pointed out, it's kind of that secret passcode between two organizations here. And certainly, you know, when it kind of comes to man in the middle attacks, it certainly prevents that, because the individual who may intercept that token looks at it and that information is useless to them. You know, they can't do anything with it. It's just a bunch, as you pointed out, it's a bunch of jumbled up, kind of like when you ask for a really strong password key. It's kind of just a bunch of random characters, but to end points, they understand what that means. That does provide information for them. So I certainly find that aspect certainly very, very interesting. But now, Jim, I'm curious, because I kind of want to do a little bit of role playing here, and perhaps we can kind of dive into a little bit of this. So let's just say, for example, that I'm a consumer and I'm about to make a high value purchase. Let's just say like a vacation, for instance, right? And I'm well within my credit limit. So my first initial question that I want to ask is that, why do some of these transactions sometimes get declined?
Ryan, there's first system issues. As Tim alluded to, it's possible that in a situation that I'm paying for a rental in Montana, let's use that as an example, and I'm renting it, let's say it's $10,000 for the month I'm renting it. And it's possible that somewhere between PayPal, the card issuer, our acquirer, Visa, the relationship bank that the renter is utilizing, that there's some system problem that prevents that transaction from going through. So one, there just could be a data connectivity issue associated with that. The more likely scenario would be a situation where at one point of that exchange, there is a lack of trust on you, Ryan, having $10,000 to be able to spend for that, and the models that the issuer are using and the acquirer are using to authenticate you and to authenticate the transaction, number one, to make sure it's actually you. Number two would be that there's suspicion in terms of that transaction. It could be that, A, not only do we not think it's you, we actually think it's potentially a fraudulent transaction. It also could be a situation that we don't know who the buyer is, in this case you, or more importantly, in a lot of decline situations, we don't know who the seller, or in this case the renter, I'm sorry, the person that's leasing the property. And a lot of times what happens is that the issuing systems work predicated on the idea of knowing both sides of those transactions. So it's easy to know that Jim shopped at Walmart, and the issuer will know who Walmart is and will know who Jim is. When that merchant is no longer known, that creates risk within the issuer systems to be able to say, should I let that transaction go? Especially when it's a high amount transaction. And so you do see more prevalence, and I could point to my phone right now, of my bank sending me text messages. Is it really who you are, and are you really making a transaction with that person, is probably the first big step in that direction. But it's a myriad of different data points that come together, and it's typically uncertainty about knowing who you are or knowing who the merchant is that leads to that decline.
Yeah, if we had perfect identity, I think a lot of those issues would go away, right? But that doesn't exist. And so we use more and more data points to try to nail down exactly who I am when I'm in a transaction. Drives me nuts. I forget that I've turned on my virtual connection to protect my data on the internet when I'm connected to the office. But then when I go to log into my bank, they see me coming from a totally different location, and they send up an additional authentication mechanism to prevent me from logging in until they know exactly who I am. So all these different ways of figuring out who you are as a person, your behavior, your device identity, your personal identity, and behavioral biometrics, all of these go in, and if they don't line up, you're liable to get turned down.
Yeah, and I mean, really what we're kind of getting at here is just the predictive analytics side of things, right? So from really kind of a machine learning perspective that kind of sits there and says, okay, along the journey of identifying or knowing that this individual says who they say they are, or the merchant, and all these different points, the machine learning is really kind of using like a percentage along the way to be able to say like, okay, we have this amount of confidence that this is an actual transaction and everything is good and it's a good wholesome payment here. So Jim, I'd like to get then from your perspective of how are PayPal's machine learning models predictive?
Well, Ryan, we have at last count about 50 petabytes of data on online transactions, which is a lot of data. It basically, I think it's sort of like take the Library of Congress to the moon and back several hundred times in terms of the amount of, if you stacked every book as you go through that. And because we've had a long history of working with pretty much anyone that's done a legitimate, and probably in many cases tried to do an illegitimate transaction on the web, we just have a ton of data around pattern recognition. So Ryan, if you had never gone to Montana, or you had never done a vacation before, or you had never made a purchase from your phone or the same phone that you're making that particular purchase, we would probably think that transaction, we had suspicion of you not necessarily making that transaction, you being legitimate as you go through. But there's lots of, as Tim alluded to, lots of tiny bits of data that we can then work through this in terms of, in our world, for example, you may have never made a $10,000 transaction for a rental, but within our ecosystem, we may have seen you just collect $9,000 P2P transactions from friends within your Venmo circle. And we go, well, that seems that he would likely now make a purchase with those transactions as we're going through this. And so it's not the obvious that we often are looking at. It's the less obvious that when we look for correlative type of behavior that then triggers data for us to say, hey, that's a very legitimate transaction. So for example, your issuer would likely have no information that you just received $1,000 purchases, and all saying the Venmo description and that emoji, a picture of the big sky or something as you go through this. And while you might find that silly, those bits of images and data become very, very important for us to understand who you are and what your behavior is and your next actions that you're taking.
PayPal is in a great position to patch together that crazy patchwork quilt of data and to be able to make better decisions with it.
Yeah, now, and I know, obviously, you know, speaking of PayPal specifically, there's certainly a lot of products and services that your organization offers. And I'd like to focus then here specifically on the PayPal wallet. So, Jim, what specifically then happens, let's just say, if a transaction is declined within the PayPal wallet?
So what we will do is, let's imagine it's a card transaction. And in this case, what we will do is we'll basically look at, is there an alternative way to route that transaction? Is there a way to basically think that the pattern that we use, the road that we took to get to your issuer, was there any reason to think that potentially the data was corrupted along the way? Is there some variable that perhaps didn't get passed along the way? And as we think about that, what we will do almost instantaneously once a transaction is to look through, is there an alternative way to route the transaction through a different network, through a different acquirer? Is there data variables that we passed? And you know, for example, one instance could be that we have seen situations, as much as we love network tokens, is that the issuer system would approve the actual 16-digit called PAN, which is basically your personal account number associated with that. There are situations that sometimes they'll reject a token and they'll approve a PAN as they go through this, just because there may be something on their side that they're tweaking. And so the first thing we'll try to do is then to retry the transaction as we work through that. The second thing that we'll do is we will look in terms of, are there alternative funding options that the consumer in this case, and use your example, Ryan, you may have another credit card that we can utilize. We can potentially tap into your bank account, your balance. So we'll try different forms of payment until we actually get it so it works. And I think one of the values of PayPal and our PayPal wallet, and why we've seen such a high improvement of our auth rate, especially for the branded transactions at about 300 basis points of improvement, is because we have multiple funding options. And so it's no different than you're sitting in Walmart and for whatever reason your credit card doesn't work and you have three other tender types that you can utilize. We also create the capability to do something called split payment that allows you to use multiple payment options for that particular transaction as we work through this. And so those are all the things that we'll go through. Last but not least, what we try to do is through alerts and messaging is to signal to the particular customer that says, hey, your transaction didn't work. And is there another form of payment that you want to utilize? And what we're starting to model now is a variant of that, which is something we call VIP stand-in. And stand-in's basically a mechanism that the payments industry has used for several years that when systems go down, stand-in kicks in, and we like the very literal term, stand-in for the issuing systems and basically do decisioning on that. And so what we have started to do, if Ryan, you're a long-standing user, Tim's a long-standing good customer, we know that decline happened not because you're not who you are or you don't have the money. It just, there's something happened within the ecosystem that prevented that. So what we'll do is go to you and say, hey, we'll honor that transaction and we'll collect it from you later. And so these are all tools that we have within our ecosystem because of good data, good history, and multiple funding options that we can utilize to make sure that would have been a decline. Maybe someone else would have gotten the vacation rental in Montana and all the other people would be bummed out. We make sure that that's a situation that you've got that transaction taken care of and you don't need to worry about it thereafter.
All truly remarkable capabilities. That's kind of unique to that PayPal account. It's very cool.
You know, Jim, I'm glad that you brought up the stand-in description there and kind of the example, because this next scenario that I want to propose to you is kind of really taking a look at it from the merchant perspective. So let's just say that I'm a merchant that's trying to book or do an order, and I run into kind of that system outage, so to speak. Maybe it was a lost connectivity or something like that. How does PayPal then specifically stand in for a purchase when merchants face technical issues?
Yeah, so real life example, we've had instances where either the acquirers, there could be network connectivity failures, or very rarely, but it does happen, that one of the payment networks and issuers have an outage. And in effect, what we do is when you go on to make that purchase, in this case, your rental, we will basically identify you, again, through our data and knowing as best we can, correlating your identity to be able to say, yeah, it really is Ryan, and know that Ryan almost has a line of credit with us, and basically saying that we're able to extend you instant credit for that transaction because we know who you are, we know your history, and we have a high reason to believe that even if you didn't pay for it right now, you're going to pay for it later on. And so effectively what we do is we authorize that transaction, say, Ryan, that's a good transaction. We're going to replay it thereafter. So effectively what we do during the outage is say to you, you've got it. The payment has gone through and we collect and do the transaction processing when the systems come back up and are available. And so from a merchant point of view, it gives you comfort that regardless of whether I had some problem on my end or within the payments ecosystem, I'm not going to miss a sale. My customers aren't going to be dissatisfied, and they're not going to go to another merchant to make that transaction. It will all be taken care of because we're standing in for them.
Yeah, and I think that's extremely important to point out, because really at the end of the day, when we're really kind of talking about authorization rates and everything that goes on behind it, really what the merchant cares about is, hey, did I make the sale? Did it go through? Did I get paid for the goods and services that I delivered? So I certainly think that's an extremely useful benefit for the merchant on their end. But now I want to point out to a data point that I saw recently from Juniper Research that predicted that 130 billion in card not present fraud for global merchants between 2019 and 2020-21 here. The question then that I've got for you, Jim, based upon that data point there, is how do machine learning and real-time decisioning differentiate between good and bad transactions?
Again, it comes down, Ryan, to pattern recognition. And pattern recognition in terms of what we will have seen, and again, interesting when you talk to our machine learning AI teams, they can pretty much predict what you're going to eat for lunch 3 weeks from now based upon what you've done over the course of the last several weeks. And the reason why I say that is that, the behavior of good people tend to have predictable patterns. The behavior of bad actors tend to have unpredictable patterns. And so that may sound very obvious, but in reality, when you're looking at lots of different predictive behaviors, we've been able to say, hey, if you do the following things, if you shop at the following merchants, if you have an ecosystem around P2P payments that looks like this, just profiling from a behavioral point of view, good actors, you then are able to draw, very high confident information about whether or not Ryan is Ryan and he's actually legitimately trying to make this transaction or not. So I think it goes back to that preponderance of data and then creating a lot of correlative attributes around that. I think the other piece that we then look at, as I said, it takes two to tango often from a fraud standpoint. And, our information and insight on merchants in particular become quite important in terms of our ability to understand who's a good merchant, who's going to fulfill on goods or not. Because sometimes fraud can be both consumer, me showing up not as Jim. It also could be a merchant who basically doesn't fulfill their orders and they're basically putting up shoddy merchandise or not really being able to deliver things as they go through this. And so, for us, it has been years in the making. And again, as Tim indicated, being able to use different technology to identify people. So again, the device ID on the phone is a very commonly used way. But again, if I know your device ID, I can basically authenticate you. Other things that we're able to do now, and this again may sound somewhat science fiction, but it's actually true. We can tell by how you type in your information, the pattern by how quickly you're typing in your password, how quickly in certain cases you're holding the phone, and there's telemetry that's utilized that says that, I usually will hold the phone in my right hand at a, let's just call it a 45 degree angle. If I'm coming in with the left hand, that seems suspicious for us as someone going through this. And so all this data points, both, hard data and then soft data that we use to sort of infer good versus bad.
To a large extent, it's about the data that you can collect. And PayPal is in the right position to be able to collect an amazing amount of data, not just from the merchant and the consumer, but also from the issuer and the networks. So being able to leverage that data with machine learning tools, AI, is certainly going to differentiate you. There are those out there like Google and Amazon that are really pushing the boundaries of machine learning capabilities to improve decision-making, but you can't do that without data. So you're in the right place. PayPal has a wealth of data to be able to improve authorization rates and detect fraud. And it's gonna be fun to watch it going forward.
Yeah, no, one of the things that, as we're kind of bringing up just the amount of data and where the data can come from that PayPal can essentially access and get to there, it then kind of brings up the term of a two-sided network here. And perhaps maybe, Jim, you could kind of dive into specifically what it is that that term means. And then kind of, I think, kind of recap of how that is that it's beneficial for PayPal's data scientists.
So when we think of PayPal, one of the things that, again, we believe what makes us quite unique is that we have a community of consumers or payors in a community of merchants and businesses that are basically payees. And both of those sides of our network are those that are individuals, businesses, merchants that board in our environment. So we do some know our customer activity associated with them. We have relationships with both. We can contact both. So we're almost in a perfect position to know both sides of a transaction. So we'll know, again, if who Ryan is, we'll know the renter of the property that the property that a person's trying to rent that property to Ryan as we go through this. And we have a long history with them. And you know, we've seen situations where an individual is buying something from someone in Japan. And again, a typical one-sided relationship, which what an issuer has, is basically they know who you are, and they may have very coarse information through something called the MCC code or merchant category code to know that you're buying shoes from someone in Japan. But that's the extent of what you know about that particular other side of the transaction. The fact that we've had 20 years of working with that shoe sales merchant within Japan, that's data and information that gives us confidence that that's a legitimate transaction. Again, traditional ecosystem players have one, not both. And so again, the ability to effectively adjudicate and make decisions based upon that richness of data and those relationships are things that we feel are really differentiating for us and allow us to create great auth rates for our customers.
Yeah, now before we close things out here, I kind of want to take a little bit of a loop back to something that we were talking about before in terms of retrying the payment on that end, right? Because obviously that if, you know, say there's an outage or anything like that, obviously we want to make sure that we can try so that way then the merchant gets that success and the customer gets their purchases and everybody within the payments ecosystem, including the customer, is happy on there. So for a merchant that's facing a decline transactions, what are really the ins and outs of retrying the same transactions? And then also, why is it important to have a retry strategy? And how does PayPal really help with that?
So think of retries as just a process by which we try all and every alternative way to approve a transaction. For us, good transaction approval is what we want to get to 100%. Obviously, there are bad actors, and we want to make sure that those bad actors are not approved as we go through this. And the other thing that's really important for us is that we've been able to improve our authorization rates and at the same time keeping our risk losses low. So you could basically have great approval rates by approving every transaction, and you'd have a significant loss problem for you because the bad actors would be going through this. Conversely, you could have a situation that you have great loss rates in terms of how low they are, and you just have pretty poor decline rates as you go through this. And so for us, the mechanism of a retry is to exhaust every possibility. It's looking at, do we try different data variables? Do we provide token or not token as we go through this? Do we utilize the ability to potentially process a transaction as a domestic transaction versus a cross-border transaction? In our work, and Tim alluded to, with the issuers and the networks, and we've created over 40 different issuing and network partnerships. One of the cornerstones of that has been, let's make sure every good user gets approved. And so we've created almost customized routing logic that works for us and our customers under the auspices of, we want to make sure that every good actor gets their transactions approved. And so a lot of it is just sort of tweaking data, tweaking mechanisms by which those transactions are passed. And then, as I mentioned before, leveraging alternative funding sources that a customer may have available for them. And then, as I said, last but not least, our retry logic is effectively to say, we're going to retry later when we know the systems are going to work based upon we know that Ryan and Tim are good actors and approve those transactions now.
Just to another way to make things happen and to get that transaction through. All good stuff.
Yeah, certainly have to agree with that last point there. So Jim and Tim, thank you so much for taking the time today for walking us through authorization rates in PayPal. And I hope to have both of you back on the podcast real soon.
Thank you, Ryan.